Section 3. The Land of Cotton. An American Story. Solomon Northup was born free in Minerva, New York, about 1808. His parents were successful farmers. Northup, his wife, and three children also prospered in agriculture, although he supplemented his income as a violinist. In March 1841, two white men offered Northup a job as a musician in their circus. Northup accepted the job and left for Washington, D.C. 2 days after arriving in the nation's capital, he was drugged, robbed of his money and papers, chained, and sold to slave traders. For the next 12 years, Northup lived in bondage in the sugarcane and cotton regions of Louisiana. His first slaveholder, William Ford, treated him well, but Northup never stopped dreaming of freedom. In 1852, he was finally able to obtain documentation proving he was a free man. Reflecting on his experience, Northup cut to the central cruelty of the institution of slavery. There may be humane masters, as there certainly are inhumane ones. There may be slaves well-clothed, well-fed, and happy, as there surely are those half-clad, half-starved, and miserable. Nevertheless, the institution that tolerates such wrong and inhumanity is a cruel, unjust, and barbarous one. Quoted in 12 Years a Slave. The Southern Economy. The South thrived on the production of several major cash crops. In the upper southern states, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, farmers grew tobacco. Rice paddies dominated the coastal regions of South Carolina and Georgia. In Louisiana and parts of eastern Texas, fields of sugarcane stretched for miles. No crop, however, played a greater role in the South's fortunes than cotton. This crop was grown in a wide belt stretching from inland South Carolina, west through Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and into eastern Texas. Turning point. Cotton becomes king. During a visit to the South in 1793, Eli Whitney, the inventive young New Englander, noticed that removing cotton seeds by hand from the fluffy bolls was so tedious that it took a worker an entire day to separate a pound of cotton lint. An acquaintance knew of Whitney's mechanical ingenuity and suggested that he try building a machine to pick out the seeds. In only 10 days, Whitney built a simple cotton gin being short for engine, that quickly and efficiently combed the seeds out of cotton bolls. The invention of the cotton gin happened at the same time that textile mills were expanding in Europe. Mills in England and France clamored for all the cotton they could get. In 1792, the year before Whitney invented his cotton gin, the South produced about 6,000 bales of cotton. 7 years later, annual production reached 100,000 bales. Cotton soon dominated the region. By the late 1840s, Southerners were producing more than 2 million bales of cotton annually, and in 1860, production reached almost 4 million bales. That year, Southern cotton sold for a total of $191 million in European markets, nearly two-thirds of the total export trade of the United States. Southerners began saying, rightly, cotton is king. The whole interior of the Southern states was languishing, said one Southern official describing the region before the cotton gin. After Whitney's invention, he added, individuals who were depressed with poverty and sunk with idleness have suddenly risen to wealth and respectability. Our debts have been paid off, our capital's increased, and our lands are treble, or triple, in value. While the cotton gin made some Southern planters rich, it also strengthened the institution of slavery. The spread of cotton plantations all over the Deep South made the demand for slave labor skyrocket. Congress had outlawed the foreign slave trade in 1808, but a high birth rate among enslaved women, encouraged by slaveholders eager to sell new laborers at high prices, kept the enslaved population growing. Between 1820 and 1860, the number of enslaved people in the South rose from 1.5 million to nearly 4 million. Industry lags. Although the South became prosperous from agriculture, it did not industrialize as quickly as the North. For the most part, the South remained a region of rural villages and plantations, with only three large cities, Baltimore, Charleston, and New Orleans. The South did have some industry. Coal, iron, salt, and copper mines, as well as ironworks and textile mills, could be found there. The region still relied heavily on imported goods, however, which worried some people. As one Southerner noted, "For what have we not looked to our northern friends? From them we get not only our clothes, carriages, saddles, hats, shoes, flour, potatoes, but even our onions and horn buttons." At this time, in 1860, manufacturing in the South accounted for only 16% of the nation's manufacturing total. Most Southerners were content to rely on agriculture. Reading check. Synthesizing. What effect did the cotton gin have on slavery in the South? Society in the South. Social attitude shaped Southern life and produced a definite class structure for the region. At the top were the planters, who owned the region's larger plantations. The 1850 census showed that in a Southern white population of just over 6 million, a total of 347,525 were slaveholders. Of this number, around 37,000 were planters, defined as those who held 20 or more enslaved people. Less than 8,000 of these planters held 50 or more people in slavery, and only 11 held 500 or more. A very small percentage of Southern slaveholders lived a life of gentility in grand mansions. Many planter mansions were little more than cottages with newly built facades. The boom in cotton production allowed some smaller-scale planters to rapidly ascend the social ladder, quickly adopting refined habits as they expanded their property. Although the wealthy planters made up a tiny group, representing less than half of 1% of white Southern families and slightly over 2% of slaveholding families, they dominated the region's economy as well as its political and legal systems. Ordinary farmers, who were often called yeoman farmers, and their families made up the vast majority of the white population. They may have held four or fewer enslaved persons, though most held none at all, and they worked on the land themselves. Here, writer Mark Twain gives his impressions of a typical small Southern farm in his book Huckleberry Finn. A rail fence around a two-acre yard, big double log house for the white folks, hewed logs with the chinks stopped up with mud or mortar, outside of the fence a garden, then the cotton fields begin, and after the fields, the woods. From Huckleberry Finn. Near the bottom of the social ladder stood the rural poor. This group, made up mostly of families living on land too barren for successful farming, scratched a meager existence from hunting and fishing, vegetable gardening, and raising a few half-wild hogs and chickens. They made up less than 10% of the white population. At the bottom of society were African Americans, 93% of them enslaved. In 1850, nearly 3.6 million African Americans lived in the South, about 37% of the total Southern population. Rounding out Southern society was a small urban class of lawyers, doctors, merchants, and other professionals. Agriculture's influence was so great that even many of these city dwellers invested in or owned farms. As one observer noted, no matter how one might begin, as lawyer, physician, clergyman, mechanic, or merchant, he ended, if prosperous, as proprietor of a rice or cotton plantation. Reading check. Identifying. What classes made up the South's social structure? Slavery. The rice and cotton plantations depended on enslaved labor for their existence. The overwhelming majority of enslaved African Americans toiled in the South's fields. Some, however, worked in the South's few industrial plants or as skilled workers, such as blacksmiths, carpenters, and coopers. Others became house servants. Enslaved African Americans working in the fields were organized using two basic labor systems. On farms and small plantations that held few enslaved people, the task system was used. Under this system, workers were given a specific set of jobs to accomplish every day and worked until these were complete. After completing their tasks, the individuals were allowed to spend the remainder of the day on their own. Some enslaved people earned money through their skill as artisans. Others cultivated personal gardens or hunted for extra food. In the 1800s, as cotton production became more common and slavery more widespread, slaveholders who owned large plantations adopted the gang system of labor. Under this system, enslaved persons were organized into work gangs that labored from sunup to sundown, plowing, planting, cultivating, or picking, depending on the season. A driver acted as the director of a work gang. Often, these individuals were enslaved people themselves, chosen for their loyalty or willingness to cooperate. They supervised the progress of the gangs, ensuring that the workers continued laboring throughout the entire day. No matter which labor system was used, slavery was a degrading experience. Frederick Douglass, who rose from slavery to become a prominent leader of the anti-slavery movement, recalled how life as an enslaved person affected him. "My natural elasticity was crushed. My intellect languished. The disposition to read departed. The cheerful spark that lingered about my eye died out. The dark night of slavery closed in upon me, and behold a man transformed to a brute. From Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. African Americans' Legal Status. In addition to enduring a lifetime of bondage, enslaved persons had few legal rights. State slave codes forbade enslaved men and women from owning property or leaving a slaveholder's premises without permission. They could not possess firearms or testify in court against a white person. Furthermore, laws banned them from learning to read and write. Society viewed enslaved persons as property and treated them that way. Free African Americans. Although most African Americans of the time lived in slavery, some did not. By 1850, some 238,000 free African Americans resided in the South. Most lived in the towns and cities of the upper southern states, especially Maryland and Virginia. A few were descended from Africans brought to the United States as indentured servants in the 1700s before the slave system became universal. Some had earned their freedom fighting in the American Revolution, and still others were the half-white children of slaveholders who had granted them freedom. There were also some former enslaved persons who had managed to purchase freedom for themselves and their families or whose slaveholders had freed them. Free African Americans occupied an ambiguous position in Southern society. In cities like Charleston and New Orleans, some were successful enough to become slaveholders themselves. One such African American was C.C. McCarty, who amassed a fortune in New Orleans by retailing imported dry goods. McCarty dispatched the sales force of 32 enslaved Africans around the state to merchandise her highly prized wares. Still, the experiences of freed African Americans differed from state to state. In some states, they had to obtain special licenses to preach or to own firearms. Like those in slavery, they always had to remember how dangerous it was to act anyway but humble and subservient when dealing with white people. Another 196,000 free African Americans lived in the North, where slavery had been outlawed, but they were not embraced there either. Samuel Ringgold Ward, who was African American, lamented that racial prejudice was ever at my elbow. As a servant, it denied me a seat at the table with my white fellow servants. Along the streets, it ever pursued, ever ridiculed, ever abused me. If I sought redress, the very complexion I wore was pointed out as the best reason for my seeking it in vain. If I desired to turn to account a little learning in the way of earning a living by it, the idea of employing a black clerk was preposterous, too absurd to be seriously entertained. Quoted in Long Memory, The Black Experience in America. Still, free African Americans could organize their own churches and voluntary associations, plus earn money from the jobs they held. An African American who not only kept his wages, but also multiplied them many times over was James Fortin of Philadelphia. He went to sea in his teens as a powder monkey, the person on board a warship who handled explosives, on a revolutionary privateer. Privateers were private ships licensed to attack enemy ships. Later, he worked as a maker of sails. By the age of 32, he owned a thriving sail factory employing 40 African American and white workers. He devoted much of his wealth to the cause of abolishing slavery. Reading check. Summarizing. What were some basic rights denied to enslaved persons? Coping with enslavement. African Americans dealt with the horrors of slavery in a variety of ways. From language to music to religion, they developed a culture that provided them with a sense of unity, pride, and mutual support. African American culture. Songs were important to many enslaved people. Field workers often used songs to pass the long work day and to help them enjoy their scant leisure time in the evening. Some songs were more provocative than most plantation owners knew, using subtle language and secret meanings to lament the singer's bondage and express a continuing hope for freedom. Songs also played a key role in one of the most important parts of African American culture, religion. By the early 1800s, large numbers of African Americans were Christians, though their Christianity sometimes incorporated religious traditions from Africa. The religious services enslaved persons held often centered around praying about their particular concern, their dreams of freedom or a better life in the next world. Resistance and rebellion. Many enslaved men and women found ways to oppose the dreadful lifestyle forced on them. Some quietly staged work slowdowns. Others broke tools or set fire to houses and barns. Still others risked beatings or mutilations to run away. Some enslaved persons turned to more violent means of rebellion. Despite the awful consequences they faced for doing so, some African Americans turned on their slaveholders and killed them. On occasion, enslaved persons plotted uprisings. In 1821, for example, Denmark Vesey, a free African-American who operated a woodworking shop in Charleston, South Carolina, planned an armed revolt to free the region's slaves. Vesey intended the uprising to culminate a lifetime spent trying to win freedom for African-Americans, but someone betrayed him and his followers, and authorities arrested and hung Vesey in 1822 before the revolt started. A group of African-Americans in Virginia did carry out an armed uprising during the early hours of August 22, 1831. Leading the attack was Nat Turner, an enslaved minister who believed God had chosen him to bring his people out of bondage. Turner and his followers killed more than 50 white men, women, and children before state and local troops put down the uprising. A court then tried Turner and sentenced him to hang. Reading check. Describing. What was life like for African Americans in the 1800s?